Care Talk with Laura Packard is a podcast covering healthcare in America from a progressive perspective. Our healthcare system is broken, and we all know insurance companies are out of control. If you don't have health insurance or don't understand the differences between insurance plans or have surprise medical bills, out-of-control prescription drug costs, or can't get the care you need, listen to Care Talk with Laura Packard weekly on Tuesdays. What's going to happen to your healthcare under the Trump administration? From prescription drug prices to health insurance costs, from healthcare for seniors and people with disabilities to reproductive care, from care for veterans to public health, including vaccinations. Healthcare experts answer your questions every week, and they go in-depth on Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, private insurance, and more. Go to healthcarevoices.org/caretalk or search for Care Talk with Laura Packard on your favorite podcast app to listen today.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein. This is Spy Talk. April is the cruelest month, T.S. Eliot wrote in his electrifying 1922 poem. And boy, so many of us can agree, if only because it's tax time. But for those of us who served in Vietnam, April brings with it the tears of memory. Memory of the chaotic death trap of Saigon as North Vietnamese tanks and troops finally rolled into the capital in a colossal final repudiation of the U.S. project, as the Long War was sometimes speciously described. Some 58,000 Americans and 2, maybe 3 million Vietnamese died before the final curtain rang down in April 1975, 50 years ago this week. One of the best chroniclers of that frantic, dolorous end is Frank Snepp, the CIA's former chief analyst in Saigon, who was right in the middle of those events and put it all down on paper in his stunning 1977 book, Decent Interval, an insider's account of Saigon's indecent end. By all expert accounts, there wasn't a single classified secret in it, but the CIA came after him anyway with a criminal prosecution for not allowing it to bury the book. Snepp is here with me today, and I'm very pleased to say he's going to tell us about the last untold spy story of the war. Frank Snepp, thanks for joining me on what is always a solemn anniversary for me, the chaotic withdrawal of U.S. forces from South Vietnam. It's been 50 years now this month. In preparation for our interview today, I asked you a few days ago whether there was anything left we did not know about the war. And it turns out there is, you said, a tale of CIA spies in the closing weeks of the war in 1975. Tell us about that.
Well, let me first say, if I may, just by way of preface, that a lot of people have asked me what I'm thinking and doing on the 50th anniversary of the fall of Vietnam. And actually, Vietnam is never far from my thoughts.
Of course.
When I look at Gaza, when I look at the crises, wherever.
Mm-hmm.
Vietnam is always part of the context. And I also have to tell you, Jeff, since you were a Vietnam hand yourself, I'm encountering ghosts these days. I keep thinking back to people who were left behind, GIs who were killed. And as this anniversary rolls around, I think of them. The ghosts are with me. They are with me as I approach this broadcast.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
The story that you're referring to, the spy story of Vietnam, is one that exists just below the surface. It hasn't been told completely until now because much of it has been classified.
Mm-hmm.
When I wrote Decent Interval, my memoir of the fall of Vietnam, published in 1977, it was shortly after the war, I was very careful not to go into details that might expose people who had been left behind or agents who had been left behind.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote about these spies in my book, but I was very careful to do so circumspectly. Now I can tell you a lot more. I can tell you this. We had two major spies operating against the enemy. They were impeccable. In any war, they would rate as pure gold. And they certainly did in Vietnam. In Decent Interval, I described one of these spies as the Hanoi source. I will get back to that in a second. We had another spy who was buried inside the Communist command. I didn't name him in Decent Interval, but we can do so now. His name is Vo Van Ba. Vo Van Ba was the best spy of the war. Vo Van Ba had been a communist sympathizer and operative in 1949. He joined the Viet Minh. He had soured on the revolution because of its penchant for winning hearts and minds through bloodshed. He didn't like that. He decided to retire from communism. He became a slash-and-burn farmer in Tay Ninh province, just northwest of Saigon. And he spent much time there just minding his own business. He got married. His wife owned a flower shop, and they were thriving. It so happened, though, that his little farm lay athwart the major pathways to and from the Communist command in South Vietnam, which would come to be known as COSVIN, or the Central Office of South Vietnam. Now, this was basically a mountain redoubt. It sat on Black Virgin Mountain above Tay Ninh province. And it was where the communists convened to draw up their plans for the Saigon area and the Delta. It was a critically important command because it controlled one of the most important theaters of the war. Pham Hung, who was a Politburo member, eventually wound up heading it up. There were other commands in South Vietnam, but COSVIN was the paramount one. And when the communists began to put together whatever operations they were going to launch, they discussed it with their cadre at COSVIN. So if you were sitting in on those meetings, you knew what the hell the enemy was going to do.
COSVIN was sometimes described as sort of the Pentagon for the communists out on the Cambodian frontier. So having a spy right at the center of that was, as you say, pure gold.
It was like having a spy in Hitler's bunker. This guy was that good. What happened was, as COSVIN operatives passed to and fro past his farmhouse, they would stop and gossip with him. They knew he'd been a Viet Minh operative. They began talking to him. The South Vietnamese police took notice, and they decided to recruit him. This is the early 1960s. And he was told that, well, since you were a communist operative, you can go back in there, pretend to be a born-again revolutionary, and begin picking up stuff and giving it to us. If not, well, we might let them know that you have. So it's better that you just side with us. This guy hated the communist anyway, and he decided to sign on. So beginning in the early 1960s, he began feeding tidbits of information to his Vietnamese police handlers. By 1965, this guy was plugged in every which way. He would sit in on communist briefings. He would come away with exactly what the communists were planning to do, not only in the Saigon area, but also in the rest of the country, because COSVIN's its own deliberations reflected what the communists had in mind elsewhere. He became a trusted member of the COSVIN company. He was a Cao Dai, which was a religious sect in the neighborhood, a big target for the communists. They said, okay, what about you begin trying to penetrate them, manipulate them, bring them into the communist fold? He said, okay.
Let me ask a question, Frank. Mm-hmm. This was, considering the ruthlessness of the Communist Party out of Hanoi and VC as we later knew them, it's a bit surprising, even astonishing, that this guy would have penetrated the enemy so easily or have been accepted, I should say, within those circles. But I guess, and this is really inside baseball for people who follow Vietnam closely, but I guess at that point, the Southern communist movement, at least, was still more broad-based and would accept nationalists in who were not necessarily hardcore communists. So that allowed him to come back in to the fold, whereas maybe later on that wouldn't have been possible. Anyway, carry on with your spy story.
Interesting observations and very cogent. He was a Southerner. There were Southerners inside the Communist Command, but I don't want to get hung up on that because, frankly, I think the whole idea that the Southerners had a voice in the revolution, independent of the North Vietnamese, the Communists, is absurd. The Communists controlled it, controlled the revolution from the North. What happened was this. Once Vo Vinh Ba began to insinuate himself into his old company at Kazan, the South Vietnamese police got some direction from the CIA. We took notice. This was in 1966-67. And by 1969, when I arrived in Vietnam, the CIA was a co-director of the Ba operation. The reason this is important is as follows. The CIA helped the South Vietnamese police orchestrate this guy and to remake him so that he would seem to be a loyal communist. The CIA, with the police help, would stage demonstrations for the communists against the government and let him take credit for it. They would set up fake hits on government outposts. They would blow them up. It was like a movie, and it was a make-believe. It seemed that people were killed, and he would take credit for the kills. And so in time, he became a trusted operative. He became, for them, their best guy operating against the local Cao Dai sect. And he delivered for them so far as they came to understand. And he began sitting in on the innermost meetings. He was so important to them that they put him in a front row in the seating chart at Cosvin up there on Black Virgin Mountain, because they didn't want any of his fellow operatives to see his face, because he was so valued as a clandestine agent, and he was working all the time now for the CIA and for the South Vietnamese police. Major Nu Phan, a South Vietnamese police officer, became his case officer in 1970. Nu Phan now lives in Orange County, California, has written about the operation and my own interactions with this guy. This was one of the reasons that we can talk about it now. He says, Nu Phan says of Vo Vinh Ba, I can confirm this because I began meeting directly with Vo Vinh Ba in 1971. Vo Vinh Ba had a photographic memory, which is pretty good for a spy. It's the kind of thing you want in a spy. And he could look at a document and come away and recite the contents of that document verbatim. He was fabulous. And what happened was that the South Vietnamese police, giving more and more control of the CIA, decided there was a time that he could really be of use. And I'm going to come to that in a moment. But I want to stop and just let you in on, again, why we can talk about this guy. After the war, the communists themselves analyzed this operation because they were trying to figure out how one old coot had so bedazzled them, had so tricked them. So they spent, beginning really in 1992-95, they began reanalyzing Vo Vinh Ba themselves. And they discovered this guy had stolen every one of the communist key secrets, that is, the secrets circulated at Cosvin, from 1965 to the end of the war. He had predicted, according to the communists, and I can confirm this, but I'm going to tell you what they said. He had predicted by 5 days the Tet Offensive, and his advance warning had helped save Saigon at that time. He had given the Americans and the South Vietnamese police the communist plan for combating Vietnamization. He had given us their plan for the 1972 offensive. He had given us the postmortem on 1968. He had given us Henry Kissinger's, all the secret details of Henry Kissinger's interactions with Le Dato in Paris during the negotiations, because those details are briefed to Cosvin. And even though Kissinger was keeping the CIA and the rest of the U.S. government in the dark about his progress in Paris with Le Dato, we were learning of this through Vo Van Ba, because he was picking up the details from briefings at Cosvin. At the end of the war, yes.
I want to get to jump back to our 50th anniversary of the chaotic withdrawal. So he became a key source for you and the CIA and ostensibly Washington, decision makers in Washington, about what the communist plan was for the end of the war as its forces began to close in on Saigon. Tell us about that.
Yes, he was. And he had by that time immersed himself in Cosvin think and what the communists were going to do. And he had alerted us in early 1975 that, in fact, after Nixon resigned, he made clear that that was a game changer for the communists in August of 1974. He said the communists were going to begin mounting an improvisatory offensive to test the new Ford administration, that they would be looking for opportunities to mount a general offensive if they arrived. And he was able to tell us where they were going with their planning. He gave us indications in early 1975 that they were going to target the Western Highlands in the upcoming offensive. And when Phuklong Province fell in January 1975, without any response from the Ford administration or from President Chu's government, they were just baffled what was going on. He let us know, Vo Van Ba let us know, that that the communists now viewed the road to Saigon as being open.
Totally open. So he was telling us, telling you, telling Washington that the road was totally open to Saigon because the South Vietnamese army was not going to fight.
Well, no.
Or was not going to fight sufficiently.
No. He was telling us that the communists viewed the opportunities as favoring them. He also was able to say that the communists had anticipated what Chu was going to do because they'd stolen Chu's plans. In other words, he gave us the global perspective. Now, let me pause here and tell you something about how he was managed. He had a local case officer, South Vietnamese case officer, Nu Phan. This was a police major. He had an American CIA case officer, John Stockwell, who was based in Tay Ninh Province. Stockwell could not meet, for obvious reasons, directly with Vo Van Ba, because Round Eye just wouldn't mix it up with a Vietnamese operative in the field. And so when Vo Van Ba needed to talk to Stockwell directly or with me, and I had been meeting with Vo Van Ba since 1971 directly, he would get into an aircraft, and he would come to Saigon, and we would debrief him at a safe house in Saigon. He would, just for your information, and just because you're a spy buff, he would disguise himself all along the way at every phase of this process. In Tay Ninh, he would go to the airfield. He would climb onto a gurney in a particular area and disguise himself as a corpse. The corpse would be loaded aboard an aircraft. He would arrive in Saigon, hop off the aircraft, dress as a woman, and he had a wig that would have shamed a Saigon pole dancer. He wore garbo glasses and a man's owsai, which looked like made him look like a woman. He would show up at the safe house in Saigon, meeting with me and or Stockwell, and he would immediately demand a Budweiser beer. He favored Budweiser because there was an urban legend in Vietnam. The United States had dropped Budweiser along the Ho Chi Minh Trail system to try to slow down infiltration. So it's sort of an ironic joke. He would demand a Budweiser as a teaser to any debriefing. Then he would demand a Salem cigarette. That, too, was an ironic joke on his part because Ho Chi Minh favored Salem cigarettes. He kept Bastos in one pocket, but Salem in another. And he would give Bastos to his fellow cadre, but when he really wanted a good smoke, I'm talking about Ho himself, he would pull out his Salem cigarette. So as a joke, inside joke, Vo Van Ba would do the same before he delivered the goods. Remember, this guy has a photographic memory. So once he'd set up the feast, he would begin to deliver. And what he delivered was always pure gold. And it was basically the centerpiece of American planning. He was deemed by Henry Kissinger himself in briefings to Ford as the greatest asset we had of the war. I want to emphasize again, he had a set of case officers. The reason I was brought in was because as the top analyst for enemy strategy in the CIA station, that was my title. I was way outside of grade. I had no competence, but that's what I ended up doing. Because of that, I met with them periodically because I brought with me secrets that nobody else had access to in his immediate case officer fraternity. And I could ask him about infiltration or whatever. Anyway, here we go.
Let me ask you a quick question. How did you ascertain that he was telling you the truth, that he wasn't an enemy double agent?
Okay, very good question. And you're on target because we'll hold the story and I'll explain this. What happened was at one particular point, his bona fides in 1970 came into question. The reason is he was providing secrets also to the Southeast Central Intelligence Organization, where he had some contacts, and he hadn't told his case officers about that. And so he was put on a polygraph test, and he blipped. He blipped. In early 1971, his bona fides, as a result, had come into question. He had been believed in part because he had given us the communist game plan for handling Vietnamization. He had given us in 1969 the postmortem on the Tet Offensive. He said the communists gotten the shit beaten out of them. They lost 60,000 people, and they weren't going to be able to mount a major offensive for 2 or 3 years. And this strengthened the logic behind Vietnamization. That's how important this reporting was. But he gave this blip on the polygraph test, okay? And I was brought in for 3 days to debrief him mano a mano. There was a recording of the conversation. I came in to cross-examine him based on my access to various secrets and to determine that he was what he said he was. I spent 3 days with him in 1971. And by the way, this is something that is reported by his Vietnamese case officer in a write-up of his own. And I confirmed to my own satisfaction that he was the real deal. He knew details that we knew only through radio intercepts and what have you. So based on that debriefing, he was viewed as solid. We urged him not to deal any further with the South Vietnamese intelligence organizations beyond the police. And he held to that. He held to that. In any event, so that's the background. You are absolutely right to ask about how you verify his bona fides. That's the way we did it. And one of the reasons I kept being brought back in to question him is because I had access to this whole set of rarefied secrets that only I was able to bring to bear in this case officer environment. Again, I wasn't this case officer. But after the war, Ambassador Graham Martin told Congress that Frank Snepp had been the guy who had been questioning him on all of his key reporting. Now, here we are. We are the beginning of April 1975. It is 4 weeks or so before the fall of Saigon. The reason intelligence is so key, because we are under terrific pressure in the embassy to mount an evacuation. But if there's a chance for negotiated settlement, any kind of stand down in the fighting, then we want to go for that. The ambassador, Ambassador Martin, became convinced that there was a chance for negotiated settlement. What we had to determine from Vo van Bahr was whether or not that was a realistic expectation. And if it was, then it was safe to soft pedal the evacuation planning. That's how important his reporting was and his information was. We had to know this if we were going to make reasoned decisions about the evacuation. On April 8th, 1975, this 3 weeks before the end, this is 3 weeks before the end, Vo van Bahr filed a report via his case officers in Tay Nim. I was in the embassy there that night, and I read that report and was stunned. It was everything that we had been hoping for. The report said that the communists planned to mount attacks in and against Saigon at the earliest possible opportunity. Now, you have to realize, we are just weeks away from the rainy season in the Saigon area. If the rainy season arrives, it'll buy a respite for the South Vietnamese. It will bog down the North Vietnamese. It could delay any takeover of Saigon. So it's key to know that if the communists are going to move against Saigon, exactly when it is, are they going to delay? Are they going to wait for the wait a little bit longer, perhaps risking getting caught in the rainy season? So I sit, I read this report. I wasn't meeting with him on this particular occasion. I read this report, and here's what it says. It says, number one, the communists will move against Saigon in the immediate future, looking for any opportunity to attack. Gone is the idea that they might delay for a couple of months. The rainy season will arrive in May. So we're talking about a window for a communist attack only up through early May. That's 4 or 5 weeks away. Number two, and this was key. This was key. He said that any talk of negotiations was just part of a ruse on Hanoi's part to throw us off balance.
A ruse, a trick,
not to believe it. And the reason that was so important is because the French and the Hungarian truce teams in Saigon, various other dupes of the communists, were passing around the word there was a chance for negotiated settlement. My boss, CIA Station Chief Polgar, had become mesmerized by these reports. So had Martin. The reason is it served their wishful thinking. There was a chance to hold off the inevitable. And here was Vo van Bahr's first report. First report indicating that all of that stuff was just bullshit and that the communists meant to move against Saigon at the earliest opportunity. Okay.
And this idea was not only shared by these U.S. and foreign figures in Saigon, but all the way up to the White House.
They're Henry Kissinger on the White House. That's right.
They were falling for this communist trick.
And they also were betting that a little more aid to Saigon would save the day. So all of this wishful thinking, this churn, was first conducive to undue optimism, and secondly, to delaying evacuation planning. Now, I want to pause a minute, because Vo van Bahr wasn't the only source of information that we relied on. We had another major source. In the war, there were two sources of information on the communists. One was Vo van Bahr, and he was the paramount one. But we had another source in Hanoi. And it so happened, I was also in direct touch and contact with this source. I will pause and tell your audience, you and I have discussed this off camera. I cannot get into detail on the identity of the Hanoi source. The CIA just recently said to me, once again, you cannot identify that source.
50 years later, this is still a secret. We have to take a break right now. Back in a sec. Okay, I'm back with Frank Snepp.
And in Decent Interval, I wrote about the source, didn't identify him. I wrote in Decent Interval that just a few days before I met, before Vo van Bahr's report of April 8, again, 3 weeks before the fall of Saigon, a few days before that, on April 1st, I met directly with the Hanoi source. I met with the Hanoi source in Saigon. I met him in the building at 22 Jalong that is famous because on the day of the evacuation, there was a shot of a helicopter on the roof of that building. I met with the Hanoi source in the penthouse just below that rooftop pad. The Hanoi source, whom I had been meeting with for 3 years, in part because the Hanoi source loved the idea that I could corroborate what he was telling me with information from Vo Van Ba. I was in a unique position. In fact, I was the only officer in the CIA station that had simultaneous contact and access to both of these key sources. And so I could cross-reference their reporting. On April 1st, after the source from Hanoi had had a couple of drinks, sat down, and by the way, this meeting was so important that CIA bigwig sat in on part of the debriefing. CIA director, Station Chief Polgar came in for the latter part of my debriefing. Ted Shackley, who was head of the Far East Division of the CIA in Saigon on a fact-finding mission, he sat in. George Carver, Director Colby's chief advisor on Vietnam, he sat in on part of the debriefing. The source from Hanoi told me, he said, the communists are on a blood scent. They will stop at nothing short of total victory. I said, when will they attack? And he said, best bet, before the end of April. So I'm going into my meeting, let me back up. I'm receiving the first important new report from Vo Van Ba just after I've talked to the source from Hanoi. What Vo Van Ba's report does is echo what the source from Hanoi has told me.
It corroborated.
Exactly.
That.
Exactly.
They're coming.
It was a perfect triangulation. Okay. So on April 9th, William Colby briefs President Ford on this latest intelligence. This is reflected in government archives. And he tells Ford, this is the most important agent we had. I was ecstatic in Saigon because I thought this meant we would see an acceleration of evacuation planning, that all of the foot dragging would slow and it would be replaced by urgency on the evacuation front. Didn't quite happen that way. And Lester Graham Martin didn't want to believe that the communists were going to move on Saigon militarily. He was hoping that he could eke out a negotiated settlement, that maybe the South Vietnamese army could be rallied, that stragglers from the northern provinces, half the North Vietnamese army had been destroyed in the past month. There were stragglers coming in from the northern provinces. Martin hoped that they could be put together into new units or insinuated into old units. They could hold Saigon until the rainy season. In the meantime, no reason to evacuate anybody. In fact, if you evacuate somebody, he felt it would create chaos and eliminate the possibility for negotiated settlement. Exactly the thing that Vo Van Ba said is not going to happen, that the Hanoi source indicated wasn't going to happen. So our choices seem fairly clear, but Martin and Kissinger thought he could bring the Soviets in to bear in this equation, that he could persuade the Soviets to approach Hanoi and give us a deal. He believed so much in his own sorcery, Kissinger did, that he felt that Vo Van Ba, whom he knew was our best agent, that, you know, just leave it aside, put it aside. Things happen after this. To add to the urgency of an evacuation. Number one, about a week after I got this report from Vo Van Ba, Cambodia fell. It's evacuated. All the Americans get out. An American task force has been set up to bring the evacuees out of Phnom Penh. It's a successful evacuation, but a minor one. But it gave Martin and everybody something to think about. Well, that evacuation worked. The urgency is under control. We can sort of sit tight and move ahead with our plans for a negotiated settlement. The second thing that happened was that coup rumors began to percolate in Saigon that Air Marshal Key might move against Chu. And if Chu were overthrown, that would mean the end of chances for a negotiated settlement. Okay? And these coup rumors made it clear that Chu was becoming a liability. Martin had hoped to keep Chu in place. But Polgar, the CIA station chief, went to him and said, look, and Mr. Ambassador, we can get a negotiated settlement if we get rid of Chu. Martin, in view of the coup rumors, and Polgar had me write up a summary of them. Polgar took these in to Ambassador Martin. He said, look, time's run out. We got to get rid of Chu if we're going to save Saigon and make room for negotiations. Martin agreed to it. He asked me to draw up a nightmare scenario, military scenario, what would likely happen if there weren't a negotiated settlement, the scenario for a military takeoff. He took it to Chu. He met with Chu using this blueprint that I had drawn up, and defense attachés all this had contributed to it. And it terrified Chu, sobered Chu into agreeing to resign. That's how it happened. That document that I had prepared was captured after the fall of Saigon by the North
and
the President.
You end up driving him to the airport.
Don't jump ahead of our story, because what happens is this. Martin and Polgar decide to get rid of Chu. They decide that this will cinch negotiations. Henry Kissinger sends word to Hanoi through the Soviets asking for leniency. And what happens is I go frigging bananas. I am terrified. And I have access to Martin and Polgar. I'm Martin's chief military briefer. I dated his daughter. I'm very tight with him. I know what these guys are thinking. I'm terrified that we're going to get mesmerized into total stasis. No planning for an evacuation in the belief that Chu's removal will bring on these negotiations and save the day. So April 17th, this is about 10 days before the end, I call Vo Van Ba in out of the bush. I meet with him directly in Saigon on April 17th. I ask him straight on, if Chu steps down, will the communists negotiate? He answered no, based on his latest information, which was just 2 days old. Number two, I said, will the communists opt for negotiated settlement? In other words, I'm trying to get him to clarify if there's been any update from his previous report. He said, absolutely not. They tried that track before. 1954 got them nowhere. They're not going to go the negotiating route. 1973 didn't work for them. They're not going to go that way again. I said, okay, then when are they going to be in Saigon? He said, they're going to be in Saigon right now, according to Cosman's planning, in time for Ho Chi Minh's birthday, which was mid-May. I said, okay, what does that mean in terms of the kickoff date? He said, late April. He said that they will, he's talking about the North Vietnamese, they will bring airstrikes in on Tan Son Air Base. He said they will bring artillery heavily to bear on Tan Son. Friends, that's exactly what happened. And he's giving me forewarning. I race back to the embassy. I think, good God, this is the report of all times. This is like having the blueprint for Pearl Harbor. And I go in to Polgar's office. Martin's there. And I say, sir, always very polite, Mr. Polgar, Mr. Ambassador, here's the latest from Vo Van Ba. Now, I got to tell you, Martin loved Vo Van Ba in other times. Martin loved him because Vo Van Ba's ability to trick the enemy, convince Martin that the enemy was flaccid, that they could be beaten. So he trusted Vo Van Ba. He loved him. In fact, Martin was a spy aficionado. He wanted to know all about him, how he was handled and how effective he was, etc. But this time, I walk in with this report, and Martin says, Frank, I don't think so. Henry's got this message into Hanoi. We're waiting for an answer. So your report is moot. I say to Polgarp, sir, shouldn't we just send this in to be on the safe side? And he was reluctant to do it, but I finally persuaded him to do it. He said, okay, you can send this report in via ops channels. That's a sewer pipe to Washington for low-level reports. When I put that report into the ops channel and it came out the other end, it blew the chart. It blew everybody off the charts. Admiral Geiler called the embassy and he said, what the hell is this report about? He didn't talk to me. He talked to Polgar. And Polgar said, well, this is the best agent and so forth. Geiler was in Saigon 2 days later to force Martin to begin planning for an emergency airlift. Jeff, that report galvanized the planning for the emergency airlift that saved us all in the end. It was Vaux van Buz's report, okay? But Martin was still reluctant. 2 days later, April 21st, Chu resigns. Martin, Kissinger, Polgar all push aside Vaux van Buz's report. Martin wrote Washington saying, well, I don't want to believe this guy. He actually says his cable refers to Vaux van Buz. He said he's just a field operative, not to be believed. Polgar was getting information from Hungarians indicating there would be a negotiated settlement. And he said, let's believe the Hungarians, not Vaux van Buz. I was stunned. Vaux van Buz was the real thing, the guy that Martin had trusted all along. Okay. So, Tu resigns. And on April 25th, several days later, pressure increases, has increased to get Tu himself out of the country. Vice President Hung has taken over. He's running the Saigon government. Polgar is trying to get, and Martin are trying to get, big man, a neutralist to step in. And they believe this will please the communists. And if your audience is going all these names, basically what's going on is that Martin and Polgar are trying to get a neutralist in place as president that the communists will negotiate with. That's what they're looking for. And so on April 25th, I'm called in and told that that night I will personally chauffeur President Tu to his own black fight out of the country. I'm a little bit terrified. Everybody in Saigon is gunning for Tu. The Viet Cong, Nguyen Cao Ky, you name it. I pick up
the army Tu. Is at the gates. The Everybody, North Vietnamese army is at
correct.
The gates.
Well, I pick up Tu, General Timmies, who was a CIA contractor, very good friend of Tu's, is in the back seat. I take the driver's wheel. And baby, we're off. It's in the dead of shutdown of the city. There are tracers out along the perimeters of Tonsonhoon Air Base. There's a firefight along the air base. And I think, man, if I get through this, this is going to be a miracle. Tu is at times weeping. He'd been drinking. He and Charles Timmies. This general with him in the back seat. We're talking about old times in Military Region 1. It was surreal. And I was introduced as a high-class chauffeur, and I'm just keeping my eye on the road, looking for the next sniper or somebody to jump out and stop us. We sweep past the sign outside of Tontonut that reads, "The noble Allied sacrifice will never be forgotten." I'll never get that. Forget that. And I thought, you know, it's a tribute to the Americans, and here we are. We're leaving all of that behind. And Tu's, I could see Tu barely in the rearview mirror, and his eyes seemed to be glistening. I thought he was crying. But anyway, we pulled out onto a black section of the airfield, and it was totally dark. I turned off the lights. I nearly ran over Polgar. He was waiting alongside an aircraft that was to take Tu out of the country, and I had to dodge. I just caught at the last minute. I saw my boss standing there, and I had to swerve to stay away from him. Everybody in the back seat sort of bounced forward. As I pulled to a stop, Tu reached around, and he grabbed my hand, and he said, "Thank you." And I must tell you, Jeff, I thought, what is he thanking me for? The 58,000 Americans who died. Is he thanking me that I didn't assassinate him? Because I'm sure he thought that this was going to be the end of the road for him. And I said, simply, I'm glad I could help. That's it. He jumped out of the car, raced up the ramp to the aircraft. Tran Tin Kim, who had just resigned as prime minister, he followed him up. He had been in another car in my caravan. As the cabin door slid shut, Martin, who was there, it was Pogar, Martin, me, and one other driver. Martin grabs the ramp, the passenger ramp, and yanks it away. It was so dramatic. This is an old guy. He's got his horn-rimmed glasses on. And I said, Mr. Ambassador, can I help you? He said, no, not Friday. And it felt like he was sundering the umbilical that had kept us connected with this lost policy of ours. I mean, that's how dramatic it was. Did it lead to a negotiated settlement? Literally within that period, the same day, April 25th, Kissinger received word from Hanoi via the Soviets. It was an exquisitely ambiguous message. North Vietnamese said, we have no problem with the United States evacuating its own. They said nothing about a Vietnamese evacuation. They said, we propose that we proceed on the basis of the Paris Accords. The Paris Accords hadn't worked, so what the hell did that mean? It was meaningless, but it came to Kissinger directly, and Kissinger believed it. So he decided we had 3 more weeks to plan for an evacuation, to get an evacuation going. Okay. The same day, the same day, the Hungarian diplomats in Saigon brought word to Pogar. They said, the North Vietnamese want you to negotiate the settlement. I'm thinking, holy shit, are you kidding me? And finally, just to complicate, and your viewers must be going nuts, but there was an arrangement that allowed an American team to visit Hanoi periodically to check on the missing in action issue, Americans lost in action. This continued right to this point, and that same day, the American team went to Hanoi, and the North Vietnamese they interacted with said, yeah, the embassy will be allowed to stay after a ceasefire, and you'll be able to continue to do your work as searching for Americans missing in action. It was the perfect, we got a message from Hanoi. We've got these guys.
We were saps.
We believe it. And I kept saying, but sir, Mr. Pogar, Mr. Ambassador, Vo Van Ba, our Hanoi source, they're on the same track. They're on the same. Okay, folks. What happens after that is that the vice president steps aside, the interim president of the country, Big Min, this neutralist, supposedly acceptable to the communists, he takes over. And 3 days later, folks, this is April 28th, and Pogar had me interacting. I went to Malcolm Brown, New York Times journalist, and we used him to send word to, this gets complicated, communist diplomats at Tan Sanut. There was a truce team there with PRG, with Viet Cong representatives, to ask them if there was a chance for a settlement. They said no. Anyway, so that's sort of where we stand. That afternoon, April 28th, Big Min gets up to give his inauguration speech. He's going to be the next president of Vietnam. Presumably, the communists will negotiate. He gets up to give his speech. The first rain showers of the monsoons begin pelting the roof of the National Assembly building. It was all very dramatic. And literally before Big Min could complete his speech, a contingent of stolen aircraft piloted by North Vietnamese airmen and South Vietnamese defectors attacked Tan Sanut Air Base. Exactly what Vo Van Ba suggested
as
was going to happen. Exactly.
Told.
Exactly. And that night, they bombed the North Vietnamese, 140,000 of them, now within 20 minutes of downtown Saigon, began pummeling Thon Son Nhut with heavy artillery. And then when that happened, I was blown out of bed. I had had no sleep for days. I was barely dozing. I raced to the embassy. This is the morning of the 29th, and this was the evacuation day. Everything that Vo Van Ba had told us had come true. Everything the Hanoi sources suggested had come true. It was a case of the intelligence providing fair warning, wishful thinking on the part of the higher-ups from Kissinger, Martin, and Pogart. It had gotten in the way. And we were making our exit because we had helicopters, thanks to Vo Van Ba's early warning. That had been prepared.
And now everyone has seen the final scenes of Saigon and its chaos. Helicopters arising from the U.S. Embassy and adjacent buildings, panic, Vietnamese trying to clamber over the walls of the embassy, helicopters flying out to aircraft carriers in the South China Sea or off the coast, crashing in the sea. That's memorialized in film and audio and interviews over the decades since. You've told us the last great spy story of the Vietnam War, but it needs reminding here that thousands of American lives, many thousands, tens of thousands of Vietnamese lives were at stake in this riveting spy story.
Yes.
And diplomatic story. And there is a lesson. We need not pound this drum again forever. We've seen this again and again. We saw this in Afghanistan. Wishful thinking overpowering the facts of solid intelligence. And it needs saying, I guess, that intelligence is important. Good intelligence is important, but it's not so important that it overrides critical, flawed thinking on the part of U.S. officials. That good intelligence ignored is disastrous. And I dare say we're seeing that in Ukraine today. All U.S. intelligence, all experts on Russia and Ukraine say that Vladimir Putin will not be satisfied with the Crimea, which the Trump administration is proposing to give away to Russia as a peace settlement. Anybody who studies Russia and the Soviets going back will know that that's not going to satisfy Vladimir Putin, but we have officials overriding the intelligence again. Frank, I know this is very, you know, it's an exciting spy story. On the other hand, it's very trying to tell. It's these stories are so corrosive to our spirit. It hurts. I'm so happy that you took the time to share it with us today. And I'm hoping that our listeners draw the same lessons from it that you and I have over the years, who were deeply involved in Vietnam, you much more deeply than I was. But I was a case officer for a short time myself in Vietnam and saw a lot of the dynamics that you describe at work.
Let me say one thing, if I may, Jeff, very quickly.
Please.
Number one, Vo Van Ba, though his intelligence wasn't believed at the end, the intelligence he had provided throughout the war saved thousands upon thousands of American lives because he gave a forewarning of other crises. And thousands upon thousands of South Vietnamese lives. He was a true South Vietnamese hero. He was extraordinary. What happened to him in the end wasn't extraordinary.
Yeah,
it was disastrous.
A sad ending.
He had decided not to evacuate. He thought he would stay behind and continue to serve the Americans. An American who had been captured, and a Vietnamese who had been captured several weeks before, gave away his identity. And so shortly after communist forces rolled into Saigon, their security people picked up Vo Van Ba, threw him in prison to await interrogation and execution. This man hung himself by his belt rather than be forced to give up friends and allies who had failed to believe him in some cases. What a hero. What a hero this man was, a true South Vietnamese patriot.
50 years later, it's still an open wound. I was distressed to learn from news reports this week that Trump administration officials have been told not to attend any ceremonies in Vietnam marking the end of the war. This is sad. Another sad ending. We had worked very hard to, both sides had worked very hard for reconciliation after the war. And that's been cast asunder by the Trump administration.
And perfectly ridiculous, because it would serve our interests vis-a-vis the Chinese. The North Vietnamese, the Vietnamese
totally.
Do not want to become a satrap of China. And here it
totally.
Is, we step back, the Chinese are going to be there with their dollars and offerings and pressure to take over part of the, much of the North Vietnamese economy, or the Vietnamese economy, I should say. So it doesn't serve our interests in any way.
No, it does not. Well, I hope to be back next week with a happier edition of the Spy Talk podcast. But we're so grateful to you come aboard today, Frank, and tell this great spy story, the last great spy story of the Vietnam War.
Thank you, Jeff.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Thanks for listening. You can find more interesting conversations like this one in our archives, available at our home at MSW Network or on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, mosey on over to our Spy Talk newsletter on Substack, where my colleagues and I offer fresh reporting and analyses from the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll find your way there. This week's Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. I'm Jeff Stein. See you around.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
It's Sunday morning. And that wonderfully relaxed feeling of a long, lazy day lingers in the air. If you want to make the moment last, may I suggest the perfect solution? The Martin Sheen Podcast. Join me, your host, Martin Sheen, for beautifully crafted 20-minute programs filled with never-before-heard stories of my life, along with personal reflections and poetry that inspires. The Martin Sheen Podcast is the perfect Sunday refresh, a chance to take a deep breath, relax, and know that the stress of Monday may be just around the corner, but not here, not now. So make this your weekly moment of calm as we explore faith, hope, love, and what it means to be human. And know this, this journey is ever unfolding as I invite you to see what's next with me, Martin Sheen, and thank you.